This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Israeli forces kill Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas leader and mastermind of the October 7th attack. And the most obvious question is, what's next? Is this a possibility of reaching peace? The number of political folks, both in the Middle East and here in the United States, are saying, yes, that this is an opportunity. Joining us to talk about that is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, senior fellow and military expert with Defense Priorities. Lieutenant Colonel, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
So I hear this chatter of, you know, this political talk and rhetoric and dialogue around that this creates an opportunity for peace in the Middle East. I'm kind of mystified by it. I watch your intel briefs that you have, and folks, I suggest that if you want some great information about all of what's going on so many different fronts around the world, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis does a great job with that. And I agree with you. I'm not so sure this is an opportunity. I'm a little mystified by that statement by so many, our president, our vice president, Bibi Netanyahu, and so many others.
You know, the best I can come up with is just wishful thinking, and we would like it to mean this, and boy, it'd be swell if it was, but there's no evidence at all that it's going to do anything. I mean, it represents just a profound misunderstanding or lack of understanding of how these kinds of terrorist-type organizations are created. Number one, that it's a resistance movement. It's been formed for decades of basically in response to the Israeli occupation of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip specifically, elected in 2005. But then they've had a militant wing that has, you know, tried to resist Israel. And of course, ever since October 7th, when Hamas had that horrific terrorist attack against Israel, and then Israel's response has been over the top. Now it's been nothing but a response to the complete destruction of the way of life inside of Gaza. And it's just irrational to think that a people, an entire 2 million group of people, is going to just submit because one man gets killed when there's, you know, literally thousands, tens of thousands have been killed so far, and the repression continues. So as long as the conditions that led to the rise of Hamas exist, so too is that resistance.
So how do we get to where we need to get, and how do we define peace? I saw your interview with Raja Menon, who's also part of Defense Priorities, and he describes Hamas as a mass movement. You read polls where somewhere between 57, 67, or 72%, if my memory serves me correct, of Palestinians don't necessarily align with Hamas, but they believe a lot of what Hamas is saying. And, you know, that there is no feeling on their part that there's any space, quite frankly, they're not in favor of a two-state solution, and that there's any space, however you want to say it, from the river to the sea, for Jews. So how do we get to,
you know, it's ironic,
you know, a plateau
a situation where, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Lieutenant Colonel, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you have this ironic situation to where, if the Palestinians use that phrase from the river to the sea, you know, everybody in the West gets all up in arms like, oh, my gosh, you know, this shows that they want to eliminate Israel, et cetera. But when Netanyahu himself uses that same exact phrase to mean the same thing and he has the power to make it good, we don't bat an eye because he says we will rule from the river to the sea. And of course, they're methodically destroying everybody in the Palestinian areas, and now it's including also increasing in the West Bank as well as the Gaza Strip. It's not quite to that same level yet, but the violence is considerable there. So to get to your point or question about what can bring to peace, until there is some kind of legitimate, viable path for the Palestinian people to have a future and a hope, that they can have some kind of state, some kind of position where they have freedom, that there won't be any peace for anyone. And Israel is just, I think that they're pursuing the unattainable by thinking and they can use enough military power to, quote, destroy Hamas, but also to continue to keep, you know, all the Palestinian people locked into this area that now can't sustain life without foreign aid for the indefinite future. I mean, it's going to take decades of time to rebuild that place once the war stops, which obviously it hasn't yet. So there's already going to be a tremendous pressure for the Palestinian people to try to get some freedom when they can't even live. And those conditions is what led to Hamas in the first place. And it's going to continue to as long as there are people living there under those conditions. That's just the harsh truth of it.
But how do you deal with the aggressive nature of the Palestinians, whether they're aligned with Hamas, whether they're aligned with the Palestinian Authority or Hezbollah? Israel has taken a defensive posture with their air defense system. They have been bombed monthly for decades. I mean, you know, so what do you do? How do you get to a point where you can identify any piece of geography that one is willing to coexist and have a coterminous boundary with? From my perspective, I don't know nearly as much as you do about that area, but it seems a little difficult to figure out how we can coexist, you know, with a coterminous boundary.
It's unquestionably difficult because there are two sides to that equation. It's not just that Israel has been
the
recipient of being bombed every month or so, as you mentioned, because there is far more violence from the Israeli side against the Palestinian side. And when you say, you know, how do you
well, they have the capacity,
their aggressiveness,
I get it.
They are being that way because they are the ones who are receiving far more of the violence than Israel. For example, in the summer leading up to October 7th of last year, when the big terrorist attack, there were over 200 Palestinians who had been killed by the IDF in both the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank. And, you know, Western people don't seem to remember any of that happened prior to October 7th. But this thing was a boiling cauldron because they kept getting killed. And when people get oppressed and killed and denied any kind of freedom, they're going to respond that way. So until that dynamic changes, so both sides come to some agreement that they can coexist, as you say, then neither side will have peace or freedom.
But one has to admit that the Palestinians were involved in aggressive behavior towards Israelis as well, and there were killings and there were beatings and there were thefts and there were any number of issues that they were having to deal with. I go back to this question. Yeah, I mean, one has the capacity. You pick a fight, and if you don't really know who you're fighting with and they happen to have a black belt in karate and you get destroyed, it's hard to complain when you're participating in picking the fight. And when you look at the polling that's done amongst Palestinians, where I'm having a big time, you know, difficulty wrapping my head around this, when they don't see any capacity for Israel as a state, why should Israel see any capacity for the Palestinians or the Palestinian Authority as a state?
That's a valid question. But there have been periods of time to where the Palestinians have said we're willing to contemplate a two-state solution, but the Israeli side is not, and that's just a fact. It's there is zero willingness on the side of the Israeli side. But like, consider this though: if as long as you say that, you are guaranteeing that there is going to be conflict because you cannot keep an entire people group literally imprisoned within the confines of the Gaza Strip and think that they're ever going to live peaceably. They just won't do it.
Oh, no, I don't. Look, I do not disagree with that assertion. And actually, there's a fairly healthy number of Israelis that I actually believe that, too. And that's why there's friction within the Netanyahu leadership in Israel today. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a smaller percentage that are interested in a two-state solution. There are some, but there are significantly more Israelis that believe,
sure,
like Netanyahu does, that there shouldn't be any two-state solution and that all the Palestinians should be driven out of Israel.
No different than the Palestinians.
And the only difference, true enough, but the difference is that one side has the power to make it happen and the other side is utterly powerless.
But that's always the case, right? I mean, when we look at some of the African nations that are there, you know, and we look at the historical tribes that are there, some tribes align with others and are able to have the capacity to browbeat the others into submission. I don't know where this is going to end. I mean, I just get the sense that our own politicians are sending us mixed messages about how this is going to ultimately play out. We keep talking about a two-state solution, but I don't see any articulable, actionable intelligence, information, data, or otherwise to believe that that's even a remote possibility in the decades to come. But yet we're still pontificating on this notion, you know, as we move forward. I'm sorry, go ahead.
As long as we continue to say we want a two-state solution with our mouths, but don't do anything at all to actually bring it into capacity, because that's going to require both the Palestinians and the Israelis to make concessions that neither wants to make. And until we're willing to use some of our leverage to compel both sides to do that, neither side is going to. And, of course, as long as Israel has our complete and total unquestioned backing, they won't make a single giving on any kind of a negotiation. They won't give anything because they don't think they have to, and therefore there will never be a solution. And we just look, frankly, stupid when we keep claiming with our mouth that we're looking for a two-state solution when we aren't.
Yeah, I mean, but the interesting thing here is, you know, you look at Jordan, you look at Syria, UAE, Egypt, others. Nobody wanted the Palestinians. In fact, very many of them pushed them out, right? Because they kept trying to overthrow
their governments. You've got to understand why. The primary issue is not that they don't like the Palestinians. Because there's great support for the Palestinians throughout all those countries you mentioned, because mainly a lot of Palestinians live there, former ones. But they don't want to be basically seen as being and helping Israel to cleanse itself of all the Arabs, which they view, and this is also important. You keep talking about, you know, both sides say they don't want the other there. Well, remember, the Palestinians were on the land before 1948 and were killed in large numbers and driven off of their land. So in their view, they want to get it back. And so that's why these Arab nations, primarily, there's other reasons too, they don't want to take them, because they don't want to say we're basically conceding that Israel is going to completely kick them off. And now then, where do they live? Now they'll be having to live in those other countries where they don't have history and they don't have the land that they had before. Now they have to be accommodated somewhere else. And you're talking millions of people. So nobody wants to take that on for multiple reasons.
But is it also not true that even in modern times, this has been a back and forth situation, whether it's the British colonialism as it relates to them taking over the Ottoman Empire? But this has never been really to any extent stable by any stretch of the imagination for any lengthy period of time, right?
Well, certainly you had the Ottoman Empire first, and then you had British, you know, especially after World War One, taking over a lot of that stuff. The Palestinian people were just, you know, they were just living on the land, and they, you know, had small states. They never had state power. That's why it was these other right. empires were able to lord it over them. But then along comes Israel in 1948 and just, you know, pushes them off the land and kills thousands of them. And takes it over. So they've just been pushed around by everybody. So they're, you know, certainly not very happy about that. And they've been lamenting for decades.
But historically, no different than what happened to the Jews in the Middle East. I mean, you know, I was listening to what Raja Menon said about, you know, that from the Palestinian perspective, Jews in Israel or Jews having an Israeli state is a historical injustice to the Palestinians. I mean, we can't just arbitrarily pick a time in history and then believe that you know, from that point forward, this is where the injustice exists without going back and gaining a bigger and broader understanding of the entire region as a whole. Wouldn't that be fair?
Certainly, but this case, I don't think this is a hard one to figure out at all, because the Jews were driven out 2,000 years ago when the Romans conquered them and pushed them out. And they weren't there in any number, but, other than just small numbers of people since the late 1800s. But the Palestinian people, the Arabs who lived there, had been there for centuries. And then they were literally forced off and killed. So I think that's a pretty clear delineation.
No, I get what you're saying, but what the point that I'm trying to make is they talk and they speak as if this has never occurred to anyone else in the Middle East. I mean, and that's been part of what has driven.
I don't think the
instability when you think about when you think about the overthrow of the Shah in Iran and everything that's gone on there, as well as Iraq and what's going on in Afghanistan for centuries. It's as though that we can just arbitrarily pick this date, and that seems to be the sum of the nation and the rights and the definition of what historical injustice may be as it relates to Israel. But I go back to this description of Hamas being a mass movement. What does that mean? I mean, as it relates to the percentage of the population of Palestinians that may not openly engage with Hamas, but believe in everything that they stand for?
The Hamas was literally, it's just a political party that was voted in 2005 to help the Palestinian people get what they wanted, which is freedom of some sort. And then, of course, Hamas, once they got in power, they basically stopped the elections, and then they just kept their political power, and they stayed that way, basically a form of a dictatorship. And, of course, the Palestinian people, they're powerless to do anything else, so they got to make do with the best they can. And they were very widely disliked prior to 10/7, especially. But since when you're faced with the side that's your people or the side that's killing you in large numbers, you know, there's a lot of people that would support them now that wouldn't have otherwise. So I think we get too focused on the term Hamas. It's a means to an end, a political means that turned into a militant wing. And right now they just want anybody that's going to bring, you know, some kind of peace. But nobody has any power to do it in Palestine. So it doesn't matter really who's in charge, because really nobody's in charge.
So what is the benefit for them to hold on to these hostages at this point in time and not just turn them over? I mean, at some point in time,
it's at least a little bit of public leverage that they have, and that's why they took them in the first place, because they wanted to try to use that to leverage to get something to benefit themselves, because they have no other leverage to use. And, of course, there's no value to them to just hand the hostages over and then give up whatever leverage they had left. And I think that Israel has chosen that they've marked them off. I don't think they expect to get any of them back, and so they're not willing to give anything. So there really isn't any leverage. They just think that there should be, but, you know, until they're all dead, or until all the Palestinian people who are holding them are dead, I think that you're going to continue to see that, because Israel is not willing to give anything up to get them back.
So do they fall back on the mantra that they talk about all the time, that they don't fear death and that they just consider it an honor? I mean, how do you negotiate with folks like that? I mean,
they do want to live. I assure you they do. And they do want to end the fighting. They definitely do. They've been saying they want negotiated settlement from the first. The issue, though, is Israel doesn't want to give anything that the other side is asking for at all. And if you don't give and take in a negotiation, there's never going to be an end until one side either destroys the other completely. Or it'll just keep fighting. I mean, that's the truth of it.
But you know, when you talk about like the Philadelphia corridor, I mean, why, and for the benefit of listening audience, that's the area in southern Lebanon, southern Israel along the border. Why would that not be a legitimate ask for the Israelis in light of everything that they've seen with the tunnels and everything that goes on there? And that's the way that they've been able to smuggle arms. It's the same thing on the north side relative to Hezbollah and the position that the UN has taken, where they, you know, there was a lot of agreement signed that they wouldn't be in certain areas. They're there, they're uncovering tunnels, they're uncovering munition dumps and everything else. How do you develop a sense of trust in anything that anybody has to say when that's what you're uncovering You know, and then on the heels of our own administration saying...
You'll see that that implies that, that somehow Israel can use all this violence that I was describing that preceded 10-7 and that the other side should do nothing. Of course, they're going to... They're the much weaker side, so they're going to do whatever they can to try and defend themselves and to push back and to get arms, et cetera. That's just the nature of war. And you said, what gives them the right or what's unreasonable? Hey, as long as you've got the power, anything you want to do is going to be reasonable. It doesn't matter what anybody says. But in a war, actions have counteractions, and it's just part of the nature of war. So it's ridiculous to suggest that the Palestinian side is not going to do whatever it can within its ability to try and fight back. And, you know, they still are on the bottom of the power dynamic. That's why they keep dying in such large numbers every day. But I'm sorry, well, I'm going to have to break contact right now because I've got another show to do real quick.
No, thank you so much, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. No, I agree with you. It is a war. Not many people refer to it as such, and everyone's going to do what they need to do to survive for sure. Thank you so much for joining us. Always appreciate your time and your insight. Have a great week.
You bet.
Thank you, sir. That's Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, senior fellow and military expert with Defense Priorities, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
And stay with us. Folks, it is finally here. Taylor Swift's Eras Tour, 3-day concert, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evening. You can feel the excitement in the streets. Diego Bufquin is here, PhD hospitality expert. He's a professor of practice and director of the hospitality unit at Tulane's Freeman School of Business. Diego, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Newell.
So help us understand the enormity of this. You know, the more I read about this this Eras tour, the more incredible it gets.
Yes. So she has pretty much fully booked the Superdome for 3 consecutive nights, right? We know that the Superdome has a capacity of 83,000 spectators. So if you do the math, I mean, we're probably going to see over 240,000 people attending her concerts. And so, you know, they are estimating that each attendee will spend about $1,500 on things like hotel accommodations, food and beverage, merchandise. And so if you do the math, I mean, you know, her concerts here in New Orleans might bring anywhere between $200 million to $300 million to the city.
And what's incredible is that it, unlike the Super Bowl, this is like really confined to just 3 days as opposed to roughly 10 days of activities leading up to the Super Bowl here. So it's a lot more compact, but man, it's just, it's a big amount of money that's going to be spent here.
Oh yes. Hotels are fully booked, for example, right? They have reached 100% occupancy. And so everyone is going to benefit from these concerts. I mean, hotels, restaurants, shops, you name it. Everybody is going to see their revenue increase, and that's a good thing for the city of New Orleans.
This kind of concert, I mean, it's been in, I think they're in Miami. She was there this past weekend in Miami, and there's been other 3-day tour dates in one city. And it's been pretty amazing, saying it's the most economic impactful concert series in the history of music. It's hard to wrap your head around that, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, she's driving revenues that we could compare with the Super Bowl. You know, that's the kind of revenue that she's bringing. And so, she's going to attract a lot of, like, families to the city of New Orleans, right? We're going to see a lot of teenage girls and their families come stay here to watch her shows. And so, you know, we're going to see a lot of people. And from a logistical standpoint, it's going to be pretty challenging, I would say, for the folks at the Superdome, you know, to manage all of these crowds and so forth, and also to manage all of these folks in the city center and so forth. That's going to be pretty challenging. It's going to be very busy, but I'm sure businesses are excited about her venue here in New Orleans.
What can we see from, like, a national marketing perspective when you have an event like this? Is there a unique benefit there as well?
Yes, I think, you know, folks who will come to New Orleans, right, and get to know the city perhaps for the first time, I mean, that's positive, right, for the city, because hopefully those folks will have a great time here, and they'll come back. That's what we hope for. We hope that the folks who will visit New Orleans to see her shows are going to come back in the future and spend even more money here. So, yes, from a marketing standpoint, I mean, this is a great thing for the city of New Orleans, because you end up attracting hundreds of thousands of people here to the city, and who are going to spend significant amounts of money, right? And right. So, yeah, from a marketing standpoint, it's really positive.
This is really helpful, too, at a time of 2024, right, to close out the books on 2024 and look at our tourism and hospitality numbers when you have a three-day event like this concert.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, the tourism sector here in New Orleans, the other day, for example, I had a guest speaker in one of my classes who works at the convention center. She told us that her projected revenue for 2024 for the convention center is going to be higher than what it was in 2019, before the pandemic started. And so, you know, the hospitality industry has almost recovered to its normalcy and reached similar numbers as the ones we had prior to the pandemic, with a few exceptions. I think hotel occupancy is still a little bit lower than what it was in 2019. But, you know, some hospitality businesses, like, for example, the convention center, they have seen revenues growing even faster than, you know, the numbers that they had back in 2019. So, you know, some sectors are doing great. Others are still playing catching up. But, Taylor Swift's concerts are definitely going to impact positively the whole sector. And we know that this is a very big sector, right? Because it's a sector that, you know, generates a ton of city sales taxes. It's a sector that employs thousands of people, that brings in an average of $10 billion a year of revenue to the city of New Orleans. And so, you know, it's a great thing for the local economy, that, you know, and her concerts are definitely going to help.
We're visiting with Diego Bufquin, PhD, professor of practice and hospitality expert at Tulane's Freeman School of Business. Diego, I was kind of curious. I had a monologue that I started today's show with. I recently traveled to the East Coast, and I talked about how clean a number of cities were that I visited there. and made the comparison to here and said that it's a big challenge for us in prettying ourselves up, because this hospitality tourism industry is getting more and more competitive. You know, there's a lot more cities that are competing for that spend. What do you see as the biggest challenge for the city of New Orleans?
Yeah, so this is actually something that I was talking to one of my guest speakers. So, you know, one of the main challenges would be safety, right? Or safety perceptions, right? Because, you know, when tourists start to look for destinations, they look for things such as cultural activities and, you know, the restaurants and things to do and so forth. But they also look for things like safety, right? And so I think we, New Orleans, is had some, you know, improvements to make in this aspect, right? This, mm-hmm. when it comes to safety. And so, you know, because you want to transmit a feeling to those who are planning to book their vacations. You want to transmit an image of a safe city, and that's something that tourists have in mind. And so this is, I would say, probably our weakest point, right? It's safety perceptions.
I was going to ask you that question. In this hospitality tourism space, is perception like closer to what, you know, is close to reality more so than in other spaces?
Those perceptions are created by what folks see in the media, right? And mm-hmm. so, you know, I just moved to New Orleans. I lived 9 years in Orlando prior to coming here, right? And so, when I first arrived, you know, when you take a look at the news and see what happens in the city, you tend to be a little cautious, right? Because you're like, oh, wow. When you read the news, you see a lot of events like or safety issues happening, right? But when you live here, then it's a completely different story. I mean, I've never felt as safe living here as anywhere else. And so, you know, I think those perceptions are produced in part or partially by what consumers or travelers see in the media. And so, of course, you know, if the only thing you read in the media is like is stuff related to crimes and all that, then, you know, of course, tourists will be a little, you know, they won't feel at ease, or they won't book their airline tickets or hotel accommodations if they feel that the city where they're planning to stay at is not safe. So, you know, I think what they read, what people read in the news versus reality, I think those two are very different worlds.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Diego Bufquin, PhD, hospitality expert at Tulane's Freeman School of Business. We really appreciate your time, your insight. Have a great week. And look forward to this weekend.
Thank you, sir.
I think the city's going to be packed for sure. Thank you. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Folks, we're going to be talking about a number of topics, a number of policy positions, and if you have a preference leading up to the election, obviously we're in early voting right now in Louisiana. You can vote, I think, through Tuesday. And please, if you have time, get out and vote. But we're going to continue to cover some of these policies. If there's a policy that you want to have more or talked about in a more robust fashion, text us, let us know, and we'll try to get some guests on. You know, we brought on Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis. He has a different perspective about the Middle East than a lot of others. Some I agree with, some I don't. But I actually enjoy learning what people are thinking and how they view certain things. And we want to do that. And we intend to do a couple of topics. The student loan forgiveness, the Biden administration has rolled out yet another iteration of a plan. And what does that mean and what doesn't it mean? And we'll try to get some subject matter experts on that topic. Also want to talk about the state of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Where is it right now? Did it actually deliver what everyone said it delivered? You don't really hear that often. You get little snippets of where there's a failure. What has it actually done to the market? Where have the failures been? I know a lot of the tax increases that were supposed to occur to be able to support, some people refer to it as the Cadillac tax or otherwise, that was to help support the Affordable Care Act. Most of those were suspended, and a lot of them have been written out of the bill, and they're no longer there. They're no longer law, and they're probably never going to be able to come back because it talks about a tax increase. And, you know, we always spend time talking with Guy Williams, and we will again today, talking about the state of the economy and certain things that are actually going on out there. But if you have a policy position that you want to talk about, I don't care how controversial it may be, we'll try and get people to talk about these issues that are subject matter experts on these issues to give you a better understanding of what's actually going on out there at the present time. There's a whole lot of things happening, promises being made by both the vice president and the former president. Kind of has me scratching my head as to how we're going to pay for all of this. The debt continues to rise. We're going to talk about that with Guy Williams as well. The interest on that debt is a huge number. And there are a lot of provisions that the Biden administration is rolling out right now in advance of the election that are going to do nothing but increase this amount of debt. So be interesting to see where we end up. But send us a text. Let us know if there's a topic that you want to hear discussed between now and the election. And we'll do our damnedest to make sure that we can make that happen. All right, we'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers talk and text line. Stay with us. Folks, don't forget you can have this show delivered directly to your phone absolutely free. Listen to all 3 hours, one specific hour, just the hottest clips. Download the Odyssey app and follow me. It's that easy. Or Scoot or Tommy Tucker, all of us, and you can listen to the entire show live. So Odyssey makes it easy to listen when you want, how you want. This goes for this show and any of the WWL shows you love. Download the free Odyssey app today and take control, or just tell your smart speaker, play WWL. When we return, we'll visit with Guy Williams, president, Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. The green are fighting against wind power, whiplash at the Federal Reserve as rate cuts may be later and smaller and more. So stay tuned. This is Newell on WWL.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.